Accession number 30260, reel 10.
And then it took a while to realize that not only was it political, but completely self-orientated. In other words, no friends. Doesn't matter if they were allies or enemy, they would work with the enemy to eliminate the friends or vice versa, with no consciousness whatsoever. And that became nasty.
Well, this is certainly a side of the Australian military and the wartime situation that I have not heard of, and it's one that sort of comes up as a bit of a surprise, I must admit.
Oh, yes. I've never realized, I never understood that such a thing did occur. But it does occur a lot. And I can see, even in modern policies today, I can see signs of that still. The best example of that is East Timor. You see, what reason has Australian to help East, to form East Timor? I mean, if you just come to think of it, just normally as people, you know, as a very small section of Timor that was run by a minority of people from Portugal that stayed there. The rest are all Indonesians. And all of a sudden the Australian government supported them and gave them a little country in Timor, East Timor. You know, economically speaking, it's not even viable. I mean, they have to have support from the world and from Australia to keep going. But the big thing behind it is, by that, the Timor Sea, where all the oil is. And instead of having to say to Indonesia, if it was Indonesian, what about that oil we wanted, they would have made not half the concession, where Little East Timor can't say anything. So it was a grab for the oil. And there is a typical example years and years after how they work.
Mm. You mentioned to me off air a situation where you were literally, you mentioned sort of playing one off against the other. And you mentioned a period when it was clear to you that Australia was doing these deals in order to side with the right side, as it
yes.
were. You mentioned Sukarno and the force that he was involved with prior to taking power.
Well, even in those days, they knew that Sukarno was an individual that purely worked for his own asset and for his own. He grabbed everything he could, money. He had learned well from the Dutch. I shouldn't say that, but that's the truth. From the colonial power, I should say. Would have been the same under the English. But you see, that didn't interest Australia. Excuse me. They don't care if a person is good or bad, if he can do things that suit for that policy, Australia, then they work with him. You see, and it doesn't matter if he is a goodie or a baddie. At that time, he was useful for the situation, so they worked with him. Then afterwards, they shake their heads, oh, he was a naughty, naughty boy. But they used him up to the extent what they wanted. That's what you learned. I learned very fast from the missions I had to do after that, that I always very much regret getting into, because I had to do things there that I can't devolve, but very poor, and things that will always weigh very, very heavily on my conscience.
What was it like when you found out that you were now going to be involved with this sort of proactive, aggressive infiltration, as it were? How did you feel? I mean, you had been trained for this, presumably.
I feel very, very bad about it. But I soon learned that there was nothing I could do about it. That was the main thing. I mean, I've always considered myself to be fairly materialistic. And I mean, I just will never pursue something that I know I can't do anything about. I got into it, and I looked at it from all angles to get out of it, and I found out it is impossible. So then you say, well, what are you going to do about it? Nothing else. So you have to carry on. But some of those things will weigh on you for a lifetime till I die. One of those worst things that lays on my conscience was a mission in which we had to eliminate a certain person because he was working for the wrong things. Well, I had to have done elimination before, but there were at least military men, and it was, well, there's war, people get killed, you have to kill people. You could somehow work with your conscience. But this person had to be, he was actually a civilian, but a high-up civilian, and he was really working for the colonial system that didn't, and doing very well in propaganda and working against the idea of giving them independence. So the natives, or the country that the resistance movement somehow couldn't track him down and couldn't do anything about it. So they said, you go and eliminate him. Gave me his residence, his that, and go in. I was fairly late, 44. So off I set. Did the normal observation, as I said, walked around a couple of nights, got an idea what time he went to work, what time he came home, what time he went to bed, and I thought that would be the best time to get in, because in Indonesia those houses all have open doors, and so through the heat, and so it was not difficult. He had a guard standing in the front who was half asleep in the night time, so that wasn't a big problem. So I thought I'd just walk in from the back, get in and get rid of him. Fear, of course, plays again a bigger. You're still scared stiff because you know there's a guard in front. There wasn't very far away. There was a house where there were 12 other guards that were, they were leaving each other, you know, so that was there. So, you know, your fear was there. So I thought, in I go. I had my Latin, my revolver, and my knife. I was hoping to kill him by knife, but then no noise was essential so that I could get away. But then you get the element of surprise that you never thought of. When I got in there, he had a woman with him in bed. And even worse, a baby next to the woman in a cradle. I rushed up, I killed him, the woman woke up, started screaming and yelling, I had to kill her, and then the baby started screaming and yelling, and I had to kill her. And then I raced out. Now you tell me how I can ever forget that. And it was absolutely an element I didn't even think of. Instead of killing the one man I had to kill a woman and a baby. Now, you can never understand how that feels. I'm sorry to say. You can I'll speak to it, tell you. But that never leaves you. And I can still hear the cry of the baby, who I then had to, I killed it to smother it, actually. You know, I didn't want to kill it, but it wouldn't stop crying. She screamed hysterically, I had to kill her. And all excuses, but my hands, blood, I can't explain that. It still has an effect on me. So I got to a stage I hated myself. And all the time looking for, the only reason that kept me sane is saying, what could I do about it? It was a situation of me or them. If I had let her scream, the guards would have come, other guards would have come, I would have been captured, that would have been the end of me. And I was too close to the war finishing, too keen to live, being selfish, you call it selfish, to give all that up. And again, through the years, you're in a situation, you never hesitate, you carry on as it was. I just worked completely subconscious. But it's still with me. Mm. So you get some very nasty effect. Not to any fault. I didn't know that there was a woman there. And I certainly didn't know there was a baby there too. I expected him to be alone in bed. So there you have that was one of the worst situations that I've ever come across. And then when you come back and you explain that, and they're twiddling around with a box of matches, and look at you as bored having to listen to that, and say, well, that's bad luck and that's all you get. But forget about it and don't talk about it.
But that whole sort of generation of, oh, stiff up a lip and get on with it,
you'll be right. And no one moment that anybody ever sort of said, can I help you with your feelings? Can I support you with your feelings? You know? Mm. Well, it's just situation. Terribly sorry, old boy. That's it. Now I'm going to have lunch. You get out.
Obviously, there is a lot that we can talk about in relation to how you have sort of continued to survive. I've spoken to blokes who knew people that just went straight down to the pub and drank themselves to death over a number of years. If you'd like, we can talk about how you feel that you have made it through.
I think I made it through two reasons. Extreme love for my wife. Extreme lucky and having a good job. Enjoying teaching. Having it a little bit my own way, in that I had a good school, good teachers, a lovely home, a wife, then children, that I had a terrific backup in all those things. I really felt that I had something to live for. And I looked at it from all sides and said, well, that's the past. You now have to get on. You're lucky. You seem to enjoy it. You've passed your exam so that you're not lost your job or anything, and you're even getting promotion. So enjoy it. And I looked at it a little bit as it was a gift back for the nasty things that happened to me. As I say, I always divided my life up into three: a very comfortable youth, the bad times when I was knocked about by everybody, and then a very, very lucky good time, you know, just to meet my wife has been a great luck. I met her in a dance hall. We had those ballroom dancing. And I met her there with her sister, and we got on well for 2 years, and, you know, then in 45 we got married, and everything fitted in well. The Australian DVA, Department of Veterans Affairs, looked after us. They gave us the mortgage for the house, you know, on a very small mortgage fee. And things went my way. And I really had a lot to live for. And I was able to say, well, this is good. Forget about the bad years. This is a little bit of a good thing after the bad thing. But you don't forget it, of course, and it'll always be with you. That is how I survived. I've been extremely lucky, you know.
Well, there is this sort of scenario where, you know, war is war, you have to do what you have to do in war. In relation to the sort of processing of a situation like that immediately after, how are you able to do the processing to carry on after a surprise
like
that?
In the beginning, you carry on, it's exactly the same process as you got into it. You have to do it, and you do it, and you're all bewildered about it, you know, all that, as I spoke of the first landing, all that sort of thing. And then you go exactly the same again. You're now in civilian, going to university, you know, finding some of the work very, very difficult to concentrate on it, because you're not used to studying anymore, and you really need a lot of patience and trying to settle down and get into the subjects that you're not really that interested in, but you're doing all right, and you think, well, if I better keep going because I'm getting a good job out of it. And you go through actually the same process as in the bad thing, except that it is a different process. But I have to do this now because I'm in it. What else am I going to do, you know? I would have liked to do my studies when I was 18 instead of at 23, you know, because the war. But instead of parties, no parties and study. And I had to study very hard for very average marks because you lose it, you know. It's not the continuous from school that you're used to it. So, and in a different language, instead of Dutch, I had to do it. It was all in English, of course, the English university. So it was hard work, but again, tremendous support from my wife. She helped me. She sat hours working with me, doing essays, how to set it out, and so, because of her English, was much better than mine, of course. So her support, and I got on, and then when I got into the practical side, the teaching side, I found that was easy. And I always got on with children, and I got on with the people around it, and I did very well. And then, you know, we had a house, picnics, and then we had a few parties, and life was very enjoyable.